Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. So, you know, we follow the markets, right? And these are publicly traded companies that we talk about on the stock market. And all of them have a variety of things going on, including a board of directors. And what goes into making those boards of directors or those individual directors qualify and be the right choice? And how long do they stay on the board? I mean, all these things affect. These are the stewards of the American economy. So what's going on with that? And, you know, I caught a recent article by one of our favorite guests, and I follow him, and I'm very pleased to tell you he's on the line with me, Maxwell Murphy, Wall Street journalist, senior editor for the CFO Journal. The blog is wsj.com/CFO. They've got a morning ledger email you can sign up for. And we got a hold of Max to get him on the program because there's a couple of great articles he wrote that I want to get his opinion and thoughts on what's happening. Max is a senior editor of the CFO Journal. He joined Wall Street Journal in 2011. Previously an equities columnist and reporter for 12 years with Dow Jones Newswires. He's got a degree in American Studies from Notre Dame and several accolades and awards during his tenure in the field. So, Max, welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
You're very welcome to come back anytime you'd like. And I saw some of these recent articles and blogs you wrote, and I really said, hey, this is good stuff. You know, what's going on? I mean, you wrote about investors demanding more info on board skills back in the middle of March. And, you know, companies need to do a better job explaining why these board members are a good choice and not just, you know, part of the good old boy or good old girl network and somebody they've got, you know, that's on their own other boards with or some other non, you know, qualification based reason. What's going on with this? And is there a movement to get more accountability for these nominations of board of directors?
I think there is a movement to get more accountability, but it's not always necessarily the company's fault, or if it's their fault, it's the fault of omission. You know, companies and their proxies, when it comes time to re-elect directors or elect directors, put brief bios in about their directors. And you know, some companies get out ahead of the curve and really do a full detailed bio that gives you just about every and explain why their directors should be on the board committees that they serve on and on the board in general. But some companies still keep things close to the vest a little bit, or just don't feel like maybe they think that their investors don't want to read everything that this person has done. But in this age of the rising activist investor, that's not really good enough anymore. If somebody's going to be, especially with cybersecurity and all of these new concerns that are coming out, when you have committees like risk and cybersecurity, or even the traditional audit committee, you know, it's enough under SEC regulations for an audit committee member to be a former CEO. But some people say, well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of CEOs may not have MBA, or they might have MBAs, but they might not have CPAs. They might not have the financial acumen to really grill the CFO to make sure that everything's going correctly. But that may also be, you know, at one point I was working on a story about companies that don't have any CFO DNA, let's call it, on their board, no former CFOs. And when I started calling the companies from the list that was given to me by a firm, they said, oh, no, they have experience. We just didn't put it in the proxy. So I think that the main thing is if you don't want the activists to challenge you and you want your investors to see why they're on the board, then you have to do a better job disclosing all of the qualifications.
That seems reasonable to me, Max. You know, a little more transparency, a little more forthright. You know, you are a publicly traded company. Do share with us why you're doing it and not necessarily giving away, you know, some sort of massive trade secret. But, you know, if these are the people that are going to be, as I said, the stewards of, you know, our American economy, and especially with some of these roles, they've got to go above and beyond to be prepared. And the cost of dealing with, you know, the shareholder cost, when you boil it all down, these are the folks to whom they're ultimately accountable. The shareholder cost of dealing with activist investors that, or lawsuits or challenges or anything down the road. It's, you know, it just makes sense to get on the front end of this. And do you expect to see much change in this direction, where there'll be structural changes to the boards, maybe in how they're paid or maybe in how long they can be on the board?
I do, and I'll tell you why. Something that dovetails along with this is ISS and Glass Lewis, the proxy recommendation firm that advise large institutions on non-binding, but how they believe that they should vote their shares in terms of governance issues and directors. They're not only starting to look for more disclosure; they're also starting to. I wrote a piece, that 70 is the new 50. It used to be that if you had a measure pass or a director get elected and they got one more than 50% of the vote, well, that's just fine. They passed. But now, if it's not 70 or 75, not only are investors going to get more antsy, whether it's a vote on say on pay or a vote on an individual director, ISS and Glass Lewis are going to start to wonder, well, if the shareholders, even though we haven't ever even said anything about them yet, if the shareholders are already voting with their wallets or with their shares and saying, we're barely passing these things, then it's incumbent upon the companies to either defend their director or explain what changes they're going to make to their compensation policies and philosophies in order to remedy the situation and get a meaningful majority of the vote. And if they don't do that, Glass Lewis and ISS are going to start recommending withholding votes or even voting against various directors or committee by committee. And so I think that company boards don't want to be distracted, and management doesn't want to be distracted by meeting with analysts and having to explain to them and mea culpa kind of situation.
Right.
They want to get back to their business. So it would make sense for most companies that are having challenges getting substantial majorities in their shareholder votes to really ramp up the disclosure and really either make changes or explain why they don't think they have to in a much more cogent way.
Well, that's reasonable. And you spoke of some of the parameters about the board. Are we seeing, a change of foot or any discussion about maybe limiting the term of directors? Is there something that might come there? And also, maybe at some point there is I want to be sensitive to this, but an age limit restriction. Pilots can't fly after a certain age. I mean, what about the stewards and the folks that are flying these corporations?
Well, it's an interesting point. There are, I believe, don't hold me to this, but I believe that they've experimented with director term limits in the UK, and I believe that for the most part, people are for it. But companies' boards do get entrenched, and that's one of the big worries of activists when you see them take a 5% stake, and then the company won't do what they want to do, and so they nominate sometimes an entire new slate of directors for the company and try to oust the old board. And then you've got on the other side of that the changing dynamic of the boardroom, and study after study that comes out and says the best performing companies have boards that are the most diverse in terms of both ethnicity and gender.
Right.
And it's been long an open secret that many boards remain the playground of elderly white men.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, there's nothing wrong with that.
Exactly. Let's just call it what it is.
Right? Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that if they're talented. I mean, there are a lot of all male, all white, old men boards that I'm sure their companies are soaring because they really have that acumen. But the pressure is on from being socially responsible just to best business practices to realize that if you're not getting voices that are all from different contingencies and constituencies, then you're not going to have the best board that you can have. So I do think that'll change over time. But then we were still only, I think, about 12% of the S&P 500 CFOs are women. I mean, that's up from 8 a few years ago, which is good, but 12% doesn't really reflect the mix of financial acumen in the business world.
Oh, absolutely. No question. That's definitely not a good assessment at all. Maxwell Murphy, ladies and gentlemen, Wall Street Journalist, Senior Editor, CFO Journal. His blog is wsj.com/CFO. We'll grab a quick break. We'll come back. More from Max. Stay right there.
Does getting financial advice seem like a game of cat and mouse? Maybe it's time to hire a fiduciary, a financial professional who puts the needs of his clients ahead of his own. A fiduciary also means an advisor should recommend products and services he believes will best serve his clients' needs, not what an insurance company or investment company tells him he has to sell. Next time you're talking to an advisor, ask him, "Are you a fiduciary? Yes or no?" If the advisor doesn't know, then the answer's probably no. This public service announcement is brought to you by Holland Financial, who wants to help you to plan stronger. For more information, call 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com.
And we are back with Maxwell Murphy. Glad to have him as a returning guest. You see why, right on the street with his nose right there down in it, which is good for us, Max. We welcome your insight and input in on these very interesting and important subjects for, you know, publicly traded companies, because guess what? We all own them. We got them inside our 401ks and mutual funds and all sorts of different ways that we are participants. We are the shareholders of these corporations, that these boards, we have elected them to provide oversight and stewardship and some leadership or an ongoing voice to the management of these publicly traded companies. So this is it's very helpful to understand that a little bit better. I want to shift gears if we can, Max, and go to another recent blog. I saw you wrote the sharp drop in the first quarter IPO activity. And when I read it, I was a little surprised. You know, I hadn't really, you know, I guess, I don't track the IPOs as much as others do in terms of the way we do management of investment monies for my firm. But I think it's real important to talk about it because, you know, the volume of IPO activity definitely is some sort of measure or indicator about business acumen, business confidence, and where things are. So, what are you seeing? Give us kind of a status update on IPO activity.
Well, last year was really a bumper crop, which is what makes the drop off in the first quarter so surprising.
Okay.
And the roaring stock market and the pent up demand that, you know, companies that were growing, especially tech companies that would have probably preferred to IPO in 2009 or 10 or 11, but held back because for obvious reasons with what the market was doing. But they and their venture capital backers are looking for that, you know, they call a liquidity event where they can take their stakes and monetize them and then put that money to work elsewhere, backing another, you know, venture business. And so there was, I think last year was the largest year for IPOs since the tech bubble of 2000 or 2001. And I think IPO experts don't think that we're anywhere near getting back to it, but we're still in the couple of hundred a year range. And
okay.
So what really happened in the first quarter, it's probably anomalous because the pipeline of deals that where companies have actually filed their registration paperwork to go public is pretty robust still. And even though it was a sharp drop off from last year, it still wasn't an overall bad quarter if you compare it to first quarters in years past. But what we're finding, you know, the experts at Renaissance Capital told me what they were finding is that when you're a development stage company and everything from Uber to Lyft to any of the companies that you could name that, you know, that are out there that haven't filed for a registration statement, but you're seeing their name all over the place because they're a hot tech company, they're getting such mammoth valuations from venture capital firms with a lot of money and who are looking for places to invest it. So if you can get money that values your company at $5 billion, or you could IPO and the roadshow at best will get you valued at $2 billion, well then you probably want to take that $5 billion valuation because, you know, you believe it, you can achieve it. I mean, once the market gets that number in its head, then it's a new discussion.
Right. That's true. Well, so the first quarter then might have been a little bit of a dip and not necessarily indicative of what's going on, because you've got some pretty high estimates for the rest of the whole calendar year for 2015.
Right. Like it could even be more than last year.
Okay.
The global volatility, especially the way oil has plunged, has kind of taken the wind out of the sails of any energy companies that wanted to go public. and the emerging market currency problems, and actually developed ones. I mean, the dollar is so strong. There are some headwinds, but it's quite possible that we'll get up into the low to mid 200s next year, or this year rather, which would be a fine year.
Well, and it may be exactly what you said, Max. It could have been just a temporary pullback, maybe some hesitation, maybe some things just, you know, didn't move as quick as they might otherwise with all of what was going on. It's a lot to digest when you see the energy stocks do what they've done. And you've also made a very good point, and that is this whole venture capital and the private equity. And you know, if a company can leverage that, and maybe they decide not to IPO because there's private equity out there looking for somewhere to go, and it seems to be circling the pool looking for the next opportunity.
Well, absolutely, and I imagine that if I were running an oil and gas exploration and production master limited partnership with designs of a Wall Street listing, and I put out my IPO in June, if I didn't rush then, as oil has come down by half since the summer, I imagine that I would be just taking my time and hoping that it went back up, because you know a lot of companies who depend on oil are just not going to get the valuations they think they deserve at these levels.
What do you think will happen specifically in that sector, Max? I'll take advantage of your insights here as well. You know, we anticipate mergers. We anticipate maybe some private equity flowing in, maybe venture capitalists coming in and trying to put some things together and then package it up and be something then that when oil does recover, which it undoubtedly will at some point, that these companies will come back even stronger and there's a way for these folks to participate?
You know, I will start with the caveat that I am not an oil or an energy reporter. I don't even play one on TV, but I do have some thoughts. I mean, I think there with the possibility that there is an agreement to lift sanctions on Iran, that will continue to drive this global supply glut that's far outpacing demand, and with the, you know, the exploration and production of the fracking that's going on in natural gas, and some of the oil boom that we have here, and we're pretty close to energy independence. I think there's a lot of headwinds against the price moving up in the short term, and that's what I think a lot of analysts are saying. But, you know, I think OPEC and a lot of other, oil companies and the countries that are members of OPEC, I think they're taking a long-term approach and realize that at some point the prices will go up. But, you know, at the same time, there's a group of companies who are quickly rising in the solar space and are claiming that they can more cheaply and efficiently in the next couple of years make power, you know, that would obviate the need for fossil fuels. So, you know, it's an interesting time. I would bet in the long run, for the same reason that even if what I'm saying comes to pass and the demand for oil is just never going to meet the supply again, oil is one of those things, I think, like gold, that even if you know in your heart of hearts it's kind of worthless, you're going to hang on to it because it's something that you hold against the recession. If the world collapsed, nobody's going to buy the gold that the people were stockpiling.
That's right.
It still makes them sleep better at night.
Exactly. Well, it's all interesting. And with, you know, your point about solar is, you know, it may be that, again, the economies around the world do build back, then we're going to need all of the above, oil, solar, and everything else we can get our hands on just to be able to handle all that demand. So we'll see how that plays out.
Right, and I think I read recently Germany is not only energy independent, it is now got so much alternative energy production that it's carbon neutral. I read a story, I'm not 100% sure, but they, you know, they're one of the largest economies in the world, maybe sixth or fifth or fourth. I don't know for exactly, but I mean, as this happens, that's going to really change the face of the energy industry. So, you know, we'll have to see.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we will, and we'll keep track of it. Maxwell Murphy, ladies and gentlemen, is our guest today, Wall Street journalist, senior editor, CFO Journal. We'll grab a quick break, and we'll come back with Max.
Have you considered an annuity as part of your retirement plan? Did you know that over the past several years, Americans put trillions of dollars into annuities? But despite their popularity, many people aren't sure about annuities. Why? Because annuities have been attacked for decades by financial folks who offer competing products or services. A lot of money is at stake, so some financial firms who only offer investments don't want you to consider an annuity. Get the facts. Find out about this valuable financial resource. Call Holland Financial today and get your free copy of Annuities as Part of Your Retirement Plan at 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com. Do you have financial questions you'd like answered on this show? Send them to questions@planstronger.com. You will remain anonymous.
And welcome back. We're with Maxwell Murphy, our returning CFO Journal senior editor. Super glad to have him. And we're getting some insights from Max with his perspective and attention to Wall Street. And, you know, I want to come back a little bit to the we talked before the first break, Max, about the IPO. And a lot of these IPOs, these are smaller companies, correct?
For the most part, yes. I mean, last year was also not only in terms of it was notable for being the biggest in about 14 years. It was also notable for having an amazing record amount of money raised because the Alibaba IPO was the largest in history.
Well, if we go below that,
you're right that most of them are you're right that they're trending to the smaller size these days.
Well, and that is it brings me to another interesting, not only interesting blog. You're more companies. More smaller companies paying dividends, and also that is there a so once these companies go public, or if they've been public for a while, another trend that I'm reading, and I want to get your thoughts on it is, you know, there seems to be this trend that smaller companies, in fact, a record number, quoting your blog, Max, that a record number of small companies in the S&P Small Cap Index. This is the 600. They paid a dividend, and it's up, what, 10% from the prior year? That's a significant change.
That's right, and I think there's a few reasons for that. I mean, small companies, like their larger peers, have had because of the risk aversion and still, you know, memories of dealing with the recession, just like large companies, they're holding on to their cash, and they're not seeing too many good places to invest it. And it's still early stages yet. Activists have gone to the mid caps. They started with the large caps. They moved to the mid caps. I don't think they've in mass gone after small caps yet. But I think that small caps realize that if they're accumulating cash, generating more than they could ever possibly use, and don't have an acquisition or an investment to make, that the best, like, you know, we were talking about activism, the best defense is a good offense,
right?
And if they start throwing off a respectable dividend and trimming their cash to more reasonable levels, they're less likely to draw scrutiny.
Yeah, or the attention. Yeah, the attention of an activist or somebody who wants to, you know, get in there. Well, and these companies, you know, when we talk about small cap, what, billion to 5 billion in total market cap?
That's about right. Yeah.
Okay. So
that number shifts over time as companies across the board get bigger, but that's not what it is now.
Okay. So we're talking about a decent sized company. I mean, but if you look at all of them, you know, you take all of these companies, you add up their value, they're still small companies by Wall Street standards. I mean, one of the things I thought was fascinating, you made the point about comparing all the publicly traded small companies to the Apple value.
Right. There are several companies, four or five of them, that including Apple, ExxonMobil, I think General Electric is another, AT&T, the amount of money that they pay out per year, those individual companies, each one of them, is more than the entire total of the dividend paying companies in the small cap 600. So that puts it in perspective. And then again, just Apple's market cap alone is more than the combined market cap of that index. So
that's just staggering.
It is staggering. You have to put the universes in context, but it does indicate that small companies want to be perceived as being on the cutting edge of shareholder returns. You would think that every small company wants to one day grow up to be a mid-cap, and once they become a mid-cap, they're going to want to grow up and become a large-cap. I mean, that's the the order of things that you'd like to do as a business, I reckon.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess if you find your niche and you're good, you stay there. But you're right. That is the expected evolution for shareholder value and maximization. The thing that's interesting is very often investors, you know, as you know, Max, overlook the whole small and even mid-cap sectors. I cannot tell you how many times people have come in for a second opinion to meet with me, and I open up the portfolio and I do my analysis, and it's 90% or more large cap stocks.
That goes back to the old days of blue chip investing.
Sure.
I think that's ingrained in people, and especially people who don't have a big risk tolerance.
Right.
But, you know, I don't invest my own personal money for ethical reasons.
Sure.
And also a lack of personal money.
Right.
But I do have a 401k, and I do try to balance that among asset classes.
Yeah.
and sizes, because I think that is smart. I mean, if you cut off an entire area of the market, you want to invest in stocks, and you cut off all but 500 companies from
right.
your investment criteria, then you're not getting the maximum potential. So, I mean, you know, whether you're going for growth or you're going for value, dividends, you know, whatever your mindset is for investing, it seems well worth someone's while if they're picking individual stocks to broaden that universe and take a look what's happening in the mid cap and the small cap.
Absolutely, and those two sectors have definitely given some strong competition to the large cap over the years. Well, listen, Max, we appreciate you being with us. You're always an excellent guest, and we'll have you back. Maxwell Murphy, ladies and gentlemen, Wall Street journalist, senior editor of CFO Journal. His blog's wsj.com/CFO, and you can sign up for his morning ledger email. Max, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, David. Anytime you need me, I'm here.
All right, we'll do that. Thank you, sir.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.